So there is this old, this deeply unsettling report about the prophet John the Baptist, who is known in the Islamic tradition as Yahya. And the report claims something that is just, well, it's startling.
It really is, yeah.
It says that out of all the prophets, Satan, or Eve-Ease, as we'll call him, was actually on more familiar terms with John than with any other prophet. Like, the text suggests they would actually just talk to each other.
Which is already a wild premise, you know?
Oh, right. So one day, John makes this really strange request. He basically says, I want you to show me the snares and the traps by which you hunt the children of Adam. He wants a guided tour of the traps.
And A.B. realizes that, you know, John's spiritual rank is just too high to refuse. So he actually agrees to it, which sets up this incredibly surreal scene.
Yeah, walk us through that scene, because the visual is just out of a horror movie.
So the next day, John shuts himself inside his house. He's completely alone in the room, waiting. And then Ibiyu enters. But he doesn't use the door. He actually squeezes his way in through a literal crack in the wall. Yeah, and the text describes his figure in this this loving, grotesque detail. It says he has a face like a baboon, but the body of a swine.
Which is just a horrific chimera.
Exactly. And his eyes and mouth, they aren't horizontal like a normal face. They are set vertically. And he has four hands. Plus, he's wearing this bizarre, almost theatrical outfit.
Like he's dressed up for a parade or something.
Kind of, yeah. He has this robe that's cinched with a belt made of many colored threads. In one hand, he's holding this great bell. And on his head, there's a heavy helmet with an iron hook hanging from it.
It's just such a vivid cinematic nightmare of an image. I'm trying to picture the sheer, you know, the sensory overload of this entity squeezing through the masonry of your living room.
It would be terrifying for anyone else.
Right. But John, being a prophet, he doesn't panic. He doesn't even recoil. He just starts interrogating him point by point, asking what every single accessory is.
He's very methodical about it.
He is. So he points to the belt and Evil B says, oh, this represents a false religion I founded. And then John asks about the colored threads. And the answer here is fascinating. Ilil E says those are all the various lures of vanity, the traps of self-display.
Which, if we translate that into modern terms, it's basically, you know, our curated profiles. The obsession with metrics.
Yes.
The endless performative loops we get tangled in just to show off for complete strangers. That's the colored threads.
But then John asks about the bell. And the answer Ibel Ease gives is genuinely chilling to me. He says, in it are gathered all the delights. When people are drinking and the joy runs dry, I sound it and they get up to dance.
That phrase, when the joy runs dry, that is haunting.
It really is.
Because it perfectly captures that frantic need to just keep the party going, right? To keep the noise level up, just so you can avoid sitting in the silence of your own reality. It's the sheer dread of a quiet moment.
And so then what about the helmet?
Right. So Ibelio says, by the helmet, I shield myself from the curses of the faithful. It's basically an armor made of pure defiance. It deflects whatever spiritual pushback people try to throw at him.
Okay. So John has seen all the gear, but then he asks the real question. The one this entire encounter hinges on. He looks at this monster and asks, have you ever beaten me?
And EAEC admits, no, I haven't. But, and there's always a but, he says, you have one trait I love. When you break your fast, you eat to the full. And that fullness costs you a little of your prayer, a little of your night vigil.
Wow.
Yeah, it makes him heavy, lethargic. It introduces this tiny physical drag into his spiritual momentum.
And John's response is immediate. He recognizes the vulnerability instantly. He just says, then I make a covenant with God. I will never eat my fill again.
And Ibelios realizes he has just been beaten back from the absolute last, tiniest crack in John's armor. So he replies, and I make a covenant. I will never again give a believer sincere advice. And he just leaves, squeezes back through that same crack, and he never comes back.
We really have to sit with this scene for a moment, because it serves as the doorway to the deepest, probably the strangest text we're going to explore in this series.
Think about the precision of that trap, too.
Exactly.
Ibelis didn't catch a prophet with a bell of delights or a belt of false religion. Those are for ordinary people, right?
Yep.
He caught him with a full stomach. A tiny sliver of ordinary, entirely justifiable self-indulgence.
Out of all those elaborate, grotesque lures, the only thing that actually works on a being of John's caliber is just, you know, dinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sheer mundanity of the trap that gets me.
It is so mundane.
But to understand why that trap works and how the light reaches that crack in John the Baptist's wall, we really need to set the table for today's discussion, because this is the finale of our 5-part deep dive into the foundational treatises of Ah El Aimé.
And it has been a journey that has fundamentally rewired how we look at reality, honestly.
Absolutely. So for those of you who have been with us through the previous four deep dives, let's look at where we are on the map. Because over the last few sessions, we've mostly been looking up.
In our first two dives, we explored the unbounded reality, the idea of Tawheed, the oneness of God that completely shatters all our little conceptual boxes.
Then in part three, we looked at how that seamless reality wears 100 faces through the divine names, and how human beings actually vanish into those names.
Yeah, and then in our last dive, part four, we waded into that really deep churning water of destiny and human freedom. So we're always looking up toward the infinite.
But if you step back from all that, there's a pretty gaping hole in the map we've drawn so far.
There is.
If God is pure, infinite, undivided light, and you, the listener, you know, going about your day, sitting in traffic or folding your laundry, are this limited, dusty creature living in a messy material world, how does the infinite actually reach the finite?
Right. What is the intermediary? What is in between the two? Because it can't just be an empty void.
Yeah.
You don't just jump from an infinite, timeless reality straight into a physical cup of coffee or traffic jam without some kind of, well, translation process. And that is the ultimate question Ah-El-Eh Ahmet is answering today. His thesis is that existence does not leap from God to the material world in a single unbridgeable jump. It steps down.
It's graded.
Exactly. It is graded like a massive staircase. And those divine names we discussed previously, they are the actual stairs.
So the whole Quranic vocabulary that can sometimes sound to our modern ears like a child's picture book of heaven with the thrones, the footstools, the angels, the devil's Ael Ahmet, argues that this is not just metaphor.
Not at all.
It is a highly precise technical map of that descent.
So to understand that crack in the wall and the devil squeezing through it, we have to start at the very top of this unseen architecture and just work our way down floor by floor. We need to look at the blueprint of this four-story universe.
Let's map it out then. So Ael-Eh Ahmet divides reality into four distinct worlds, and they are stacked by the intensity of their being. And we're going to name each one slowly so you can really hold them in your mind as we descend.
Right. So at the very top, we have Lahut. Yes. This is the world of divinity, the realm of the divine names and attributes. It is the absolute highest layer of created reality. It's the very threshold of God himself.
Okay, so that's floor four, the penthouse.
Right. And below that is the next floor down, Jabarut.
Jabarut.
This is the world of pure intellect and pure spirit. There are no bodies here, no time, no decay, no physical dimensions whatsoever. It's a realm of absolute immateriality. This is actually where the great archangels belong.
Okay, and then we step down to the next floor, which I think is perhaps the most fascinating and honestly subtle to grasp, especially for modern minds. Mm. It's called Malakut, or sometimes Mithel.
The imaginal kingdom.
Yes, the imaginal kingdom. Now, we really need to pause here and clarify something, because if we say imaginal, we are so conditioned to hear imaginary.
Oh, absolutely.
We immediately think of daydreams, things that are fake, things that just aren't real.
And it is so crucial to separate those two concepts. The imaginal world is intensely real. It consists of living forms and vivid images. It's not raw, dense physical matter, but it's also not bare, abstract intellect like the floor above it in Jabarut.
It has shape to it.
Exactly. It has shape, color, and form, but no physical mass. It is the realm your consciousness briefly brushes against when you have a profoundly vivid dream that feels, you know, more real than waking life.
It's also where the Barzakh is located, right?
Yes, the Barzakh, which is the intermediate state between death and resurrection. It's basically the layer where realities exist as these vivid, potent blueprints before they harden and solidify into physical facts.
And finally, at the very bottom of the staircase, we have Nasut.
Nasut.
That is our material, sensible world, the realm of time, space, decay, and physical matter. It's literally the dust floor we are standing on right now.
So just to quickly recap the structure for you, you have Lahut, Jabarut, Malakut, and Nasut.
The names, the intellect, the imaginal, and the material.
You've got it.
So I'm picturing this as like light shining down through a four-story building. At the top floor, it's blindingly pure, just absolute radiance. And as it goes down through the thick glass of each floor, it gets denser, more refracted, more particular, until it hits the ground floor where we live.
That's a great visual.
But I have to push back on the mechanics of this descent for a second. Because if the light or the existence moves down from the top floor to get to us down here, doesn't it leave the top floor empty? I mean, think about pouring water from a pitcher into a glass. To fill the glass on the table, the pitcher in your hand has to empty out. Doesn't the descent of reality deplete the source?
That is a very natural assumption to make, and it is the exact intuition LMA wants to correct here. He introduces a technical concept to explain this called tahafi, which translates roughly to vacating, and he insists that the descent of existence is not a vacating.
So it's not a pouring out. It's less like pouring water and more like lighting a candle from another candle. When you touch a fresh wick to a burning flame, the original flame isn't diminished at all just because it sparked a second one.
Yes.
The light duplicates and descends without exhausting the source.
That analogy perfectly captures the mechanism. When the light fills the lower room, the source upstairs is not drained by a single drop. To ground this, LMA points to a specific verse, Quran 15.21. And I'm going to read this slowly, because if you really absorb it, it changes everything about how you view the mundane objects around you.
Go ahead.
The verse says, "There is no thing whose treasuries are not with us, and we send it down only in a known measure."
There is no thing whose treasuries are not with us. Let's just sit with the weight of that for a second. That means every single thing down here on the ground floor, the microphone I'm speaking into, the trees outside your window, your own physical body, has a treasury up there.
LAMA says that everything has two faces. It has a creaturely face, which is measured, limited, confined to time and space, and eventually perishes. And it has a divine face that is unmeasured, overflowing, and abiding in the treasuries.
So the you that is listening to this deep dive right now, that is the measured, creaturely face of you. It's the version of you that gets tired, that ages, that occupies a specific chair in specific room.
Right.
But there is a divine face of you, an overflowing, unmeasured existence up there in Lahut that never left the source. It stays entirely full, even while the trickle-down, measured version of you appears down here in Nasut.
And that completely upends the feeling of isolation we all tend to carry around. It means you aren't just this disconnected, decaying biological unit wandering around on a rock in space.
Yeah.
You are the bottom tip of a continuous vertical column of existence that reaches all the way up through the imaginal, through the intellect, straight to the divine names. You are tethered to the infinite at every moment.
And speaking of the names, they are the actual vehicles that carry this existence down the stairs, aren't they?
Yes, and you can see this in how human beings instinctively operate when they are pushed to the edge. Think about it. When someone is deathly ill and they pray, they don't raise their hands and cry out, "Oh, death bringer, please heal me."
That would be absurd.
Exactly. They call out, "Oh, healer," or "Oh, merciful." They instinctively reach for the exact specific name, the precise stair on the staircase, that carries the specific type of existence they need down into the material world.
That's so true.
By LAMA's count, over 500 Quranic verses explain a particular act in the world by explicitly naming the divine attribute it flows through. The names are literally the pipelines of reality.
So the light is stepping down these four floors.
Yeah.
But as it descends, what does it actually encounter? Because when we read scripture, we constantly hear about these massive cosmic artifacts. The throne, the footstool, the pen, the tablet.
Right, the furniture.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us have this lingering mental cartoon of God sitting in a very large, ornate living room in the sky, surrounded by really big golden furniture.
It's a very persistent cartoon, and LAMA addresses it head on. The furniture isn't furniture.
We need to dismantle this entirely. So the Quran frequently mentions a throne al-Arsh. It mentions a footstool al-Kursi, a pen al-Kalam, and a tablet al-Law. If we are stripping away the imagery of celestial carpentry, what are we actually talking about here?
We are talking about levels of God's active living knowledge. LAMA urges us to take these terms completely seriously. They appear far too often and with too much structural importance in scripture to just wave away as mere poetry or metaphor.
Right.
But we must abandon the physical dimensions. There is this magnificent historical exchange that perfectly illustrates this. It's a debate between Ali, the first imam, and a Christian patriarch, or Catholicos. And the patriarch is pressing Ali on the physical nature of the throne.
And Ali's response is just a complete paradigm shift. He says the throne, quote, is not, as you suppose, in the form of a couch. Rather, it is a bounded, created, governed thing. Your lord is its owner, but not in the way one body sits upon another.
And then he delivers the absolute hammer blow to the spatial argument.
He does. He says, God bears the throne and the heavens and the earth and all that is in them.
God bears the throne. Think about how radical that inversion is.
Yeah.
The throne does not hold God up. God holds the throne in existence. The spatial metaphor of a king resting his physical weight on a chair is completely shattered.
The way I've always tried to conceptualize this, and let me know if this holds up to L.A. Mez's rigorous standard, is like a modern political seat of power.
Okay, I like that.
When a news anchor says a ruling came down from the Crown today or the Oval Office issued a statement, we don't assume a literal wooden chair or an elliptical room actually drafted a legal document.
Right, of course not.
We understand it as metonymy. We mean the concentrated cockpit of governance, the highest level of reality where the authority, the knowledge, and the will of the state reside.
That analogy tracks beautifully with LAMA's philosophy. The divine throne, Al-Arsh, is the level of reality on that staircase, where all the attributes creation needs become manifest at once. It is the cockpit from which the detailed governance of every single creature flows.
It's a rank of knowledge.
It is a rank of God's active knowledge. And notice the word active. It's the kind of knowledge that runs a universe, not the kind of passive observational knowledge that just sits back and watches one unfold.
But I have to push back here. Because if the throne is the ultimate cockpit of governance where all knowledge is gathered, why do we need another piece of furniture? The footstool, a kursi, sounds completely redundant. Why have a secondary seat of power?
It seems redundant until you look at how execution actually works in reality. If the throne is the inner gathered reality of cosmic knowledge, the absolute singularity of command, the footstool is where that knowledge fans out into distinct categories, species, and laws. To build on your analogy, if the throne is the Oval Office where the central directive is born, the footstool is the vast network of cabinet departments and federal agencies where that directive is categorized, specialized, and prepared for actual execution in the physical world.
That makes perfect sense.
The tradition states that the footstool is the manifest face of this knowledge, while the throne is its inner side. They aren't two separate pieces of furniture. They are two depths of the exact same knowing.
When I look at the incredible biodiversity of the planet, you know, millions of species, these incredibly complex ecosystems, I'm actually looking at the footstool refracting that divine command into myriad forms.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have the gathering of knowledge and the fanning out of knowledge. What about the pen and the tablet? Scripture talks about the mother of the book, al-Kitab. Are we talking about a giant ledger where all history is pre-written?
Again, we have to look at what writing actually is at a philosophical level.
Oh.
L.A. Mez makes a remarkably sharp point here regarding the nature of language. The mother of the book cannot be written in letters or words as we understand them.
Why not?
Because letters spell words, and words represent concepts, and concepts are inherently general.
Right. Language is always an abstraction. If I say the word tree, I'm using a general concept that can apply to a million different trees. An oak, a pine, a bonsai. The word itself doesn't contain the rough bark of a specific oak in my backyard.
Exactly. Language is a net with wide holes. Reality just slips right through it. But the mother of the book contains the total, unchangeable reality of every unrepeatable particular.
Every single one.
Every specific leaf falling from a specific branch at a specific millisecond in a specific gust of wind. It is God's absolute knowing of each individual thing existing as that thing's own higher reality. It is the master copy of existence, completely beyond the abstraction of words.
But this brings us right back to the tension we wrestled with in part four of our deep dive. If the mother of the book is the master copy, and it contains every specific falling leaf, what about human agency? What about changing our destiny? Because if it's all in the master copy, we're just playing out a pre-written script.
And this is where L.A. Mez reveals the true brilliance of the unseen architecture. Because below that unchangeable mother of the book, there is a lower tablet.
The lower tablet.
Yes. It is called the Tablet of Effacement and Confirmation Law Alma Wal Ithbat.
The edible draft layer.
Exactly. This is the level of Bara. It is the realm of contingent realities where things genuinely can and do change based on conditions. The Quran says God effaces and confirms whatever he wills, and with him is the mother of the book.
So the cosmos has a published, unalterable layer and a lower working draft layer.
Think of it like compiling a massive piece of software or writing a novel where the characters themselves actually have input on the messy draft before the final immutable print. When you pray, when you give to charity, when you genuinely repent, you are interacting with that draft layer.
Your actions edit the draft.
Your actions can actually edit what is written there, altering the trajectory of your life, even while the master copy remains serene and perfectly known to God.
That is just such an empowering concept. When people ask, you know, why bother praying if everything's already written? The answer is that you actually live, act, and pray within the editable draft layer of reality.
Yeah.
Your choices are the ink on the tablet of effacement and confirmation. connection.
It completely reconciles destiny and free will.
It really does. And speaking of the sheer scale of this reality, L.A.M. Yin touches on the physical cosmos too, doesn't he? And we have to remember, he was writing these treatises in 1940s Iran. This was long before the Hubble telescope showed us the deep field of galaxies.
His perspective on the cosmos is absolutely staggering for his time. He points out that scripture describes seven heavens, but he argues that our entire visible, star-filled sky, everything modern astronomy can see, all the billions of galaxies we can observe, is merely the lowest of those seven heavens.
The lowest one.
He describes the Milky Way as just a strap, like the cinched throat of a giant sack. He mentions seven moving Earths, Earths hanging in the air, worlds that didn't just pop into existence all at once, and countless worlds that have already passed away.
He was essentially looking at the scriptural cosmology and saying, do not box this into a tiny medieval terrarium. It is unfathomably vast.
Right.
But a universe this vast, governed by this fanned-out knowledge cascading down from the throne, it doesn't just run on dead automatic laws of physics,
right?
It requires administration. The gears of reality have to be turned by something.
Which brings us to the actual workforce of the cosmos, the angels, the messengers made of light.
And once again, we need to completely erase a persistent cultural cartoon. When I say angel, most people immediately picture a beautiful human being with giant swan wings attached to their shoulder blades, wearing a white robe, maybe holding a harp or a flaming sword.
Yeah, we have to scrub that image from our minds completely. Angels, as L.A. argues, are entirely immaterial beings. They belong to the upper floors of our building to Jabarut, the world of pure intellect, and Malakut, the imaginal kingdom.
So they don't have physical bodies.
No, you can never photograph an angel because they are the structural lattice that physical reality itself stands upon. They aren't objects in the world. They are the forces running it.
So what are they actually doing? Because the tradition doesn't describe them as a monolith. They aren't all just doing the exact same job of delivering messages or playing harps.
Not at all. The tradition sorts them into three main classes, and the hierarchy is fascinating. The first class is the enraptured, the cherubim. In Arabic, they are called the kerubiyun.
And these are the ones who are so utterly absorbed in the grandeur and majesty of God that they have absolutely zero attention left for anything else.
None. Not for themselves, not for the universe. There is actually a subclass of these angels called the Aelin. And the texts say that the Aelin were not even commanded to bow to Adam because they do not even know that the physical universe or human beings were ever created.
Let's dwell on that for a second. They don't know we exist.
They have no idea.
That is a terrifying blow to our anthropocentric view of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
We like to think humanity is the absolute center of the cosmic drama, right? That all of heaven is watching us. And yet, there is an entire class of beings of immense power that have never once glanced in our direction.
It's not out of ignorance or arrogance either. It's because nothing other than God has ever entered their gaze. They are pure, uninterrupted focus on the divine. And to give you a sense of their staggering ontological weight, their sheer density of existence, think of the story of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Moses asks to see God. And God directs just one of these enraptured angels to disclose a tiny fraction of itself to the mountain. And the mountain literally crumbles to dust.
It's like staring at a spiritual quasar. That's not a guy with wings and a sword. That is the sheer crushing pressure of a being that is nothing but a transparent window onto the infinite. The physical world literally cannot bear the weight of its presence.
Then you have the second class, the worshippers. Imam Ali describes them in a famous passage as literally filling the heavens, leaving not a hand's breadth of space.
Oh.
He says, some in prostration, never bowing, some bowing, never standing, some in ranks, never breaking, some glorifying, never wearying, whom no sleep overtakes, no heedlessness, no slackness. Their very mode of existence is ceaseless, unwavering adoration. They're the humming engine of worship that sustains the cosmos.
And then we get to the third class, the ones we interact with the most, even if we are completely oblivious to it. The administrators.
The massive civil service of reality. The list of their duties in the tradition is staggering. There are angels charged with the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars, angels of night and day, angels of clouds, rain, thunder, and wind.
They govern everything.
Angels governing mountains and seas, plants, animals, and human beings. Angels recording deeds, managing lifespans, delivering sustenance, executing death. Angels managing the Barzakh and the resurrection. At the very top of this vast administrative bureaucracy sit the great archangels, Gabriel Jibril, Michael Mikhail, Israfil, and Azrael.
So let me ask the question that a modern, scientifically minded skeptic would immediately throw out.
Okay, let's hear it.
When it rains, science tells us it's a matter of atmospheric pressure, temperature changes, evaporation, and condensation. We can track it on a weather radar. So is it atmospheric pressure or is it an angel driving the clouds?
It is both. This is the crucial shifting perspective Al-Aimeh is trying to induce. The angels are the living agencies and forces through which God's will reaches us. They personify the laws of nature.
Okay, unpack that a bit more.
You can describe the physical mechanism, the atmospheric pressure, the thermodynamics, but the tradition is saying that mechanism is not a dead, blind gear turning in a void. It is alive. Think about the difference between watching a green blob move across a digital weather radar and stepping outside to actually feel the physical rain hit your face.
Right.
The radar is the physical mechanism. The rain is the living reality. Every single raindrop is consciously delivered. Nothing in this entire cosmology runs itself. Reality is deeply, irreducibly personal at its core.
So there is a living, luminous source for every good thing, every drop of rain, every gust of wind, descending to us through the ranks of angels. But philosophical symmetry demands that if there is a downward flow of light and good, we also have to look at the unseen source of evil.
Yes.
And this leads us directly back to the grotesque figure we met in the locked room during our cold open. Satan, the first to say I.
And here, Al-Aimeh offers what is arguably his most penetrating philosophical argument in the entire series. He strips away all the mythology, all the horror movie tropes, and asks a fundamental question. What is the true anatomy of a sin?
Right, because we usually think of a sin as just breaking a rule. You're given a cosmic speed limit and you go over it. You step out of bounds. But Al-Aimeh goes so much deeper than behavioral compliance.
He starts by looking at the opposite, obedience. Mm. He says that true obedience isn't just begrudgingly following an order while wishing you didn't have to. It is wanting what the commander wants because the commander wants it. In that moment of perfect obedience, your own will passes away into his will. You become transparent.
Now, invert that. What is the root of disobedience? It is the refusal of that passing away. It is the aggressive assertion of a separate self, a rival existence standing in opposition to the commander.
And Al-Aimeh calls this ananeia. It translates to eininess.
Inus. It perfectly connects to the premise of Tawhid from our first deep dive. If God is the only self-standing independent reality, then sin isn't paying homage to a rival God out there in the woods. It's forgetting that your own existence is entirely borrowed.
Exactly.
It's claiming ownership over yourself. So every sin, no matter what it is, from a tiny white lie to absolute, sweeping tyranny, boils down to just two ingredients: heedlessness of God plus the claim of I.
That is the entire anatomy of evil. And because of the logic of this four-story universe we've mapped out, everything that happens down here in the material world has a source one rung up in the imaginal world.
In Malakut.
Right. So that structure of I-ness must have a living source in Malakut. And that source, Al-Aimeh says, is Satan. Satan is not a little red man with a pitchfork. Satan is the imaginal level reality of I-ness itself. He is the living, vibrating principle of me, not you.
Which completely recontextualizes the oldest story in the text.
Right.
Why Iblis refused to bow to Adam. In the Quran, Iblis protests the command, saying, "You created me from fire and him from clay." But the tradition goes deeper, saying Iblis was the first to say I. His very essence is the assertion of self.
Exactly. So he literally cannot bow to Adam, who is the luminous vice-regent of God, without ceasing to be himself. It's an ontological impossibility for him. And look at the materials they're made of. This is a brilliant philosophical observation by Al-Aimeh. Angels are made of light. What does light do?
It illuminates.
It is pure transparency. It reveals everything it shines upon without asserting its own form. You don't look at light. You look at what the light illuminates.
Right. But Satan is made of fire. And fire does the exact opposite. Fire consumes, it agitates, it throws heat, it combusts, it insists entirely upon its own presence. You look at a fire.
The two substances are their two spiritual stations: transparency versus combustion, pure yielding versus fierce assertion.
So, if Satan is the living principle of I-ness, how on earth do you escape him? If every time you assert your I, every time you feel a surge of pride or self-importance, you are aligning with that fire, what is the defense?
The only total immunity, Al-Aimeh argues, is Ile's sincerity. But we have to define sincerity carefully in this context. It doesn't just mean being earnest or telling the truth. It means the complete emptying of the I, the extinguishing of self-regard.
And the astonishing thing is that Iblis himself concedes this point in the scripture.
He does. Let's read that quote slowly because it's the key to the whole psychological battle. Iblis swears an oath to God saying, "I shall lead them all astray except your sincere servants among them." That's Quran 38.8283. He openly admits his limitation.
Why are the sincere untouched?
Because Satan needs the eye as a handhold. His whispers need an ego to latch onto. Think of it like trying to light a fire on a perfectly smooth, frictionless surface of glass. There's nothing to catch.
That makes a lot of sense.
If there is no eye vibrating with self-importance, there is no surface area for the fire to combust. No eye, no handhold. The prophet famously said, "My Satan submitted at my hand." This is the concept of fauna that we discussed in part 3, where the self vanishes into God. But here we see it acting as armor. The self that has disappeared into God is the one locked room that evil simply cannot enter.
Which brings us right back to our cold open. John the Baptist in the locked room. L.A. Mayo points out that Satan intervenes in human life in 3 ways. First, by whispering thoughts into the heart.
Right.
But prophets are too pure. Their eye is too diminished for internal whispering to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's no handhold in sight, which is why John encountered him as an external, visible, grotesque figure in the room. Second, physical affliction, like with Job. And third, dressing up the world to make sin look attractive.
The belle of delights, the colored threads of vanity.
Exactly. The tradition advises saying, in the name of God, over even the smallest daily actions, just to cancel out his footing in those worldly dresses. The prophet gave this haunting warning. Satan flows in the son of Adam like blood. So narrow his channels by hunger.
Narrow his channels.
And that is what John was shown. He saw this parade of snares, the helmet, the belt. But the punchline was that even a prophet, someone with immense spiritual rank, had a crack. And it was just a full stomach.
That one tiny finger width of comfort.
Yeah, just saying, I want to feel full. Enough for the fire to reach him and make his prayers just a little heavier, a little less transparent. And John's defense wasn't to put on magical armor or recite a spell. His defense was to make himself less, I will never eat my fill again. He starved the eye. He narrowed the channel.
Which brings us to the philosophical summit of this entire series. Because right now, a modern listener might be thinking, okay, this is beautifully poetic. But when I make a mistake, when I sin, if I introspect, I don't see a literal devil in my mind.
No, I just feel my own desires. I feel my neurochemistry. I feel my amygdala acting up. Is Satan just an archaic metaphor for my own psychological faculties?
It's the ultimate modern objection, right? If I look inside, I just see me. I don't see an extra creature called Ebel-E-Aziz sitting next to my decision-making process. I don't see an angel whispering in one ear and a devil in the other.
So how does L.L.A. May respond to that?
His response flips the entire universe on its head. He says, of course you don't find Satan or an angel alongside your faculties. You're looking on the wrong axis.
The wrong axis.
You're looking horizontally. You're looking around the room of your mind for an extra item. But angels and devils are not horizontal to you. They are vertical.
They are one rung up on the staircase.
Yes. They are the imaginal sources of which your inner psychological acts are the material echo.
Introspection looks around. It was never going to find what stands above.
Precisely. And here is the sentence that I believe is the deepest thought in all 4 of these treatises. I'm going to read it very slowly, and I want us to really unpack it. Ah, L.A. May writes, "The essence of the human being is like a sum of the interventions of angels and Satans, having no independent, separate essence of its own."
Having no independent, separate essence of its own. Let me see if I follow the gravity of this. I am not a static, naked little self standing in the middle who just happens to have an angel whispering in one ear and a devil whispering in the other, as if they are add-ons to the core me.
No, you are the live meeting point. Think of a musical chord. A chord is not a separate physical box that stands apart from the musical notes vibrating to create it. It is the resonance itself.
Or like a river. A river is not a separate container standing apart from the water flowing through it.
Exactly. You are not a thing standing apart from the luminous and fiery agencies that meet and contend within you every waking second.
The descending light of the angels and the rising heat of the I-ness are crossing paths. And the place where they cross is what we call the human self.
Yes. The whole 4-story universe, from Lahut at the very top, down through Jabarut and Malakut, all the way down to the dust of Nasut. It doesn't just tower somewhere in outer space above your head. Its bottom stair is you.
You are the exact location where the entire cosmos touches ground.
It reframes what it means to be human entirely, doesn't it?
It really does. And it connects perfectly to the concept of the veils, which answers the puzzle we set up way back in our first deep dive. If you remember, we asked, if God is infinite, if he is nearer than our own jugular vein, more present than light itself, why on earth don't we see him? What is blocking the view?
And this treatise gives the final answer. There is no cosmic curtain. Nothing hides God. The Quran says, not the weight of an atom escapes him. The only veil between you and God is your own existence.
Your own self-occupation.
It is that busy, loud, occupied little I that steps in front of the lens and fills your entire field of view.
Which means the veil and the devil are made of the exact same material. They're both made of the fiery stuff of the I, the assertion of self.
And therefore, the cure is one single cure. It's the same cure this entire series has been circling from different angles. In part two, we called it virtue by God and for God, dropping the ego out of doing good. In part three, we called it fauna, vanishing to find the greatest name.
And in part four, we called it owning your nothingness, so you could be free in the deep water of destiny. And here, in the finale, we call it the lifting of the last veil.
They're all the exact same act, the quieting of the eye. If you can empty that out, if you can narrow that channel, there is no veil left to hide the light, and there is no handhold left for the fire.
And suddenly you realize that the entire staircase, from the highest heaven to the lowest earth, has been standing right here the whole time, in the one place you can always reach, inside a self that has consented to be a no-self.
It's breathtaking when you pull back and look at the whole architecture we've built over these sessions.
Let's do that. Let's gather all five of these deep dives gently together, because we are at the end of the journey. We begin this series with the chaos of a battlefield. A Bedouin walked up to Imam Ali in the middle of a war and asked a deceptively simple question. Is God one?
And we discovered a God who wasn't just the biggest item on a list of items, but the unbounded, seamless reality behind every single thing. A reality that outruns even our concept of the word one.
And we watched how taking that truth seriously transforms a human life. How true courage and real generosity can only exist when they stand on nothing but God. We saw how that one seamless reality refracts into 100 beautiful names, and how the greatest name is a place you can only arrive at by getting out of the way.
We waded into the paradox of destiny and human choice and emerged realizing we are neither helpless puppets nor arrogant gods. We are free in the narrow, beautiful channel in between.
And today, we climb down the immense architecture of existence. We walk down the stairs of the names, the throne, the footstool, the mother of the book, the seven heavens. We met the immaterial forces of the angels carrying existence forward, and we faced the fiery reality of the first eye that sparked rebellion.
Only to arrive at the absolute bottom step and find ourselves.
We aren't just spectators watching a universe happen. We are the seam where the light of heaven hits the dust of earth.
The unseen architecture isn't waiting for you in the clouds after you die. It runs straight through the middle of you, right now.
But this leaves me with one final lingering thought. If we are the bottom stair, if Nasut, the material world, is the final floor where the imaginal hardens into dust, what happens when human beings create artificial intelligence?
Oh, wow.
When we encode logic and simulated thought into silicon? Are we building a new submaterial world below us? Are we extending the staircase? Or are we just rearranging the dust on the bottom floor? It's something to really think about as we step into the future.
That is a profound question for another day. But for now, the shortest path to the infinite God was never up and away. It was in and through. Think back one last time to John the Baptist in that locked room.
Right.
He asked to see the deepest, most effective snare the devil had. And that snare wasn't wealth or power or a terrifying monster. It was a single word, I.
A snare was the I. But the deepest door to the divine is that exact same word, unsaid. It is an invitation to just stop. To drop the eye for one honest moment, to empty the channel and allow the light that was always nearer to you than your own looking to simply arrive.
Thank you for climbing the entire staircase with us over these five deep dives.
Right.